Thanks for downloading this podcast. It's for personal use only and must not be broadcast, reproduced, or used in any form without permission.
Tell your friends they can get their own copy wherever they get their podcasts.
Well, hello everybody and welcome to an inside story here on the Radio Show Limited network of channels. I'm John Hindhoff and today, come about, well, what, half an hour, 40 minutes south of Frankfurt, we're just outside of Mannheim, outside a Porsche dealership. But this is a Porsche dealership with a difference. This is the headquarters in Europe of Porsche Penske Motorsport.
The inside story on the teams, suppliers and circuits. Inside on RadioLeMans.com.
Right, let's get inside and have a look around. This is, I'm going to go through the revolving door here. So you'll hear the sound change as we step in to a circular building. And here is my guide, Tobias. Thank you very much for this today. First of all, tell me who you are and what you do here.
Yeah, very warm welcome. My name is Tobias Dürheimer. I am responsible for business and operations here at PPM WEC team. And yeah, I'd like to show you around our newly opened facility of the WEC.
Tell me a little bit about the history of the building, because quite clearly it has Porsche running all the way through it. It used to be a Porsche center.
Yes, correct. It was actually the first worldwide dealership with this new CI back in the day. And used to be a franchise dealership of Porsche Germany, and then later on it got acquired by Penske Automotive. And then when Penske started to build a new dealership around 500 meters away from here, yeah, this building was not used to the full extent anymore.
It's perfect for what we have here, because it gives the opportunity for you to display some cars, which is what we'll talk about first of all, in the rotunda. There's a mezzanine level as well, and then behind that, is that a full workshop behind that, Tobias?
Correct, yeah, it's a full workshop. And quickly coming back to the building, when the partnership came about, was a big question on where the PM, the Porsche Penske Motorsport team will find his home in the WEC. And then Roger Penske actually mentioned that he has a building not far away from Porsche Motorsport headquarters. And yeah, it was the perfect match. It's only an hour away and only 40 minutes to Frankfurt Airport, near Hockenheimring, the racetrack. And yeah, it was a perfect match for what we were looking for. And yeah, it got refurbished for around 3 years. It was a multi-million dollar project. And yeah, very happy to be here now and house this professional race team.
The most obvious visual as you come in is this beautiful sweeping ramp, which is cobbled, which goes up, what, about a metre and a half from the top to the bottom. It's halfway between the floor and the mezzanine level. You use that to good effect here. On our right, we have four examples of Porsche prototype cars, in some ways with the ultimate iteration of the 919, the Evo, the record-breaking car alongside us, going up through the Le Mans winning number 19, the white and black car from the 919. Then we've got the number 7 RS Spider, and then the Dunlop number 17 car, championship winner, race winner, a lot of history. How often do you change these cars, or is it always something similar to what we see now?
Yeah, I mean, to use the showroom that was previously used for the normal road cars, now as a museum, and to showcase the history of sports cars is just perfect. And we have a partnership with the Porsche Museum. So depending on which cars are available, we exchange them about every 3 to 4 months. But we always try to be able to tell the story of the Porsche sports car and how we came up with the 963 now.
Because that is all in the 963's DNA. I should mention as well, there's the 75th anniversary coloured 963 sitting up just off to my left as well on the floor level. I'd like, if I may, Tobias, just to take a little walk past some of these. I saw this car in person, if you will, at Brands Hatch when Nick Tandy was giving it a run out. I mean, this is the ultimate iteration of the 919 with an awful lot of work. It didn't have to fall within regulations. So in some ways, the engineers basically had a free rein with this. They could do things that they would never have been allowed to do under WEC.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it's a dream for every engineer to, first of all, work on the project like the 919 and then to get the opportunity to develop it even further without, as you mentioned, any specific rules. So it's way lighter. It has more downforce, way more. All the bodywork was redeveloped. No mirrors, as you can see. And
well, you don't have to look at anything behind when you're not competing.
For sure, yeah. And, yeah, more power. So around 1,160 horsepower.
Everything was optimized on this car. The obvious bits are the side skirts. These are the bits you can see. The extended rear bodywork and a much lower slung but bigger rear wing with huge side pods, bigger rear diffuser. And this is the car that Timo Bernhard did that extraordinary lap of the Nordschleifer in.
Yeah, I mean, 5 minutes 19 seconds. Extraordinary lap, and very cool to have it still in the Porsche family because it was previously held by Stefan Bellof. And yeah, I mean, what a landmark. I mean, 5 minutes on a Nordschleife. For everybody that saw the video, it looks like it was sped up.
Yep.
And yeah, I mean, Timo did a great job. And it's always nice to see this car here and to see what could be possible if there were no regulations. Yeah,
extraordinary. And the car went on to break lap records all the way around the world as well on the 2018 tour to celebrate 70 years of Porsche. Here is the car on which effectively it was based. This is a very special car because this is the number 19, the black and white car, as I mentioned, that raced at Le Mans in 2015 and won at Le Mans in 2015. And it's not shiny. It hasn't been polished up. This is as it came off the track?
Correct, yeah. It's with the original race patina, as we like to call it, and it gets clear-coated afterwards, so you cannot really get rid of the dirt, even if you wanted to. It represents everything that the Porsche team and the drivers were going through to win the race. It's very special since it was the third car entry,
yes.
So it was none of the factory cars that won. It was actually the third car, and was, of course, the first 919 that ever won Le Mans. And that's why it's also special to have it here in Mannheim. If you come in the morning or if you leave in the evening, it's always special to look at those cars and to get motivated on what we strive for.
I wonder if we'll ever see anything as technologically advanced as this again at this time. And I'll say this, I won't expect a buyer to come in. These were the most technologically advanced racing cars in the world, bar none. And I include Formula One in that. All-wheel drive, phenomenal pieces of kit that were just pushing the boundaries all the time. And let's not forget, the ACO and the FIA, every year, were trying to turn them down for reasons of efficiency. So every year the manufacturers were being told they had to do things with less, narrower tyres, less fuel, different aero, and still they kept breaking lap records. I've got goosebumps just thinking about seeing these cars. They were incredibly quick. I remember seeing them coming out of any slow corner and accelerating. It, again, it looked like it had been speeded up. Let's go to another era and another car that I'm very familiar with, actually, because this is the RS Spyder that ran as a P2 car in the American Le Mans Series in IMSA. And in fact, this is in the colours of the championship winning car.
Yes, correct. I mean, very, very special car for this project and also for our current 963. Not only was the Porsche and Penske partnership born with this car, also the DNA of our current engine was born with this car as well, as a 3.4 litre. And actually, as you can see here, it still had side pipes. And, you know, later when it came into the 918 road car, on the original concept cars that were presented in Geneva, they also had side pipes. And later in the development phase of the car, they had too much heat in the back, and then they went and changed the valves for a hot V, and then had the exhaust coming out the back right there. And that's also how the engine is set up currently in the 963, but of course with bi-turbos. So it's another era, and I always like to say that it's this full circle moment. It basically was development from a race car. It went actually into the streets, car development and into a hypercar like the 918 Spider, and then it now came back for Le Mans, which is amazing to see.
And we should mention, of course, for those of you that don't know, please go and look it up. It's a very, very pretty car. It's a very purposeful car, but of course it has no roof. This was the last era of the open top P2 sports cars, and this car punched above its weight literally, because it was competing in the US against the P1 cars and regularly took the battle to the other manufacturers, and indeed won more than the odd once or twice. Resplendent in the yellow and red of the DHL Porsche Penske colours, with the direct fuel injection as well, which was a big innovation for this racing engine. I remember this one well, coming down to the final corner at Road Atlanta for Petit Le Mans. My goodness, what a great sight that was. Turn one at a Canadian Tyre Motorsport Park, Mosport. No lift there, straight through there, flat. Incredible. We move on to the fourth of the four historic cars that's here. And this car is so important in so many different ways. The long-tail 962, Hans-Joachim Stuck's name on the side of it, and PDK on it as well, which is very important because this was the first of the racing PDKs.
Yeah, that's correct. And I mean, nowadays you find the PDK in every Porsche 911, or even in the Cayennes and in the Macans, and everywhere in the Porsche brand family. And it was the first one, yes, correct. And very successful race car, also very specific for our project, since with the 962s they had running in the IMSA and in the FIA Group C Championship, which is what we are currently doing as well with Porsche Penske Motorsport. And also what Porsche was doing, they also had a lot of customer cars with this. And I think over 90 chassis were built, over seven Le Mans victories, so very, very successful race car.
956, 962, still for me one of the best looking race cars. The Group C era was a golden age. We're in a golden age now. And you make that point there about the customer cars. You would, because there were so many of them out on the track, you would refer to them by their sponsors or by their colour scheme. So this would have been, we would have talked about this as the Shell car. We talk about Hertz Jota in exactly the same way. So once again, it's come back full circle.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it's great that we can see so many Porsches on the grid. And it's a great competition, of course. But Porsche Penske Motorsport, the factory team, is of course trying to be on top. Yeah,
I love this car. It's fresh enough that it looks. And by the way, there's just a little bit of haze around the exhaust pipes, which tells me, like all of the cars here, in fact, that it does get fired up and it can be driven and it can be used. I'm sorry to have to leave that one behind, but Tobias has other things to do than talk to me. However, we cannot walk past this beautiful 75th anniversary colouring on the livery on the 2023 car. Yes, this is in the colours of Mathieu Jaminet, Philippe Nasr and Nick Tandy, the Bedfordshire Bullet. And this in itself, this livery was also a throwback in some respect, because the colours that were chosen, going back to what you've just said, they were commemorating and paying homage to some of those classic Porsche, some of them privateer liveries in the past.
I mean, last year was the year of the Jubilee, since we had 100 years of Le Mans. We had 75 years of Porsche, 60 years of 911. So, yeah, very special year for Porsche. And with this livery, we try to depict like all the legends from the Porsche sports car family, and you can see the, you know, pink from the pig, and the green Mamba. You can see also some of the Penske colors with the red and black, and of course the Martini blues and Rothmans. Yep. So yeah, try to
Gulf blue on there, Gulf orange on there as well.
Yeah, correct.
It was a nice little question for us to have to answer at Le Mans. All right, what are all these colours from? Name the cars that they're from. It looks fresh because it is. This one is polished. It wears the number 75, of course, and super important because this is the car, the 963, that's brought us up to date with Porsche's endurance heritage for the moment. What happens in the future? Well, we don't know, but we've got a set of regulations that are stable, which in point of fact is why Porsche and the other manufacturers are racing. So that's lovely, but we've got to keep these cars in good in good working order. And having been a dealership in the past, and you can probably just hear the acoustics changing again, we walk into what would have been the Porsche Center's service bays. It's all been stripped out. There's a light grey on the floor, and there are one, two, three, four, how many? Five?
And we have four bays, yeah. And then we have different departments around the workshop, yeah.
This is almost operating theatre clean.
Yeah, that's what we strive for. That's the expectation, of course. And as you can see, you mentioned earlier the round building in the CI of Porsche back in the day. It was a huge task to put rectangular shapes into a round building.
Yes.
So everything you can see, all the Snap-on cabinets were flown in from the US, custom made in the US with our colleagues at Mooresville, at Team Penske. And we're very happy that we have this nice workshop to work in. We have these four bays. So in bay one, as you can see right now, the guys are preparing the cars for Imola race. So currently doing setup adjustments there in bay one. Then bay two and bay three are the race car preparation bays. And bay four is our test car preparation bay.
Actually, you brought up a good point. Obviously, this is radio, so nobody can see. But those islands of the cabinets, they're wider at the back than they are at the front. So think the Flatiron building in New York. That's the architecture that we're talking about here, all in gloss black with a mat on the floor for people to work on. Bodywork to my left with I still want to call that the Salzburg car, with the white stripes on. So again, we have Porsche heritage immediately. That's the number six car in WEC. The black one is the one, the black stripes, and is the five. That's how you tell them apart.
Yeah, I mean, 917 Salzburg, I mean, everybody loves it. So it's a great heritage that we can go and look at in the Porsche family, and then get inspiration for new liveries.
Let's have a little wandering. I don't want to interrupt any of the guys who are working. So down to the left, an area for we've been set up for a pit stop here.
Correct, yeah, that's where we're going to show you some pit stop training later today. But as you can see here, we have our loading area and all the racing trucks parked outside. But then we have the specific pit stop area here as well. And the specifics of this pit stop area are quite unique, since the width of this wall is exactly the width of our fuel rig. And the height and the angle is everything is exactly like in Le Mans. And also the distances from the wall, as you can see there, to where the guys will operate on the car are the same distance than in Le Mans, so we try to replicate.
And is this always here, or is this just here for us today?
No, it's always here.
Wow.
The pit stop car is right there, the black one. It lives there when we don't do the training, but it'll come over here later in this afternoon, and then we do Monday, Wednesday, Friday, we have pit stop training. Tuesday and Thursday, we do some gym exercises in the gym upstairs with the trainer. And then we do individual training after hours or at different times with specific guys.
That's attention to detail, Tobias. But I suppose, probably even more importantly now, when we're in a BOP category, effectively, for hypercar, it's the small things, it's the 1% that make the difference.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the huge difference between IMSA and WEC is that we cannot change tires during the fuel refueling process. So it definitely is a performance area. We always have these 40 seconds that we need to stand for while doing our refueling. And we can only do a driver change or clean the car. And then once the fueler takes off the nozzle, it's go time. And that's why over 24 hours, for example, you can definitely gain or lose some time depending on your performance.
Yeah, absolutely right. Okay, let's walk back the other way past the number five, as we said, which is being set up on the flat patch at the moment. And then we've got the number five car and a spare. There's the black 963, which is stripped out, but it's a race car, so it's going to be pushed into position rather than drive into position. But it's exactly, I do actually like that black and silver colour. That's pretty evil. That's Batman's 963. Bruce Wayne would have it in that colour. And what do we have here then?
On one side, the damper area, so where our damper specialists prepare all the different sets of dampers, because we always want to have spares so we can quickly change the setup. And then on the left-hand side, you can see our sub-assembly department, where the gearboxes and all our corners and suspension get serviced and prepared. And as you can see, it has the same style than everything else, all Snap-on.
Very, very gloss black and shiny silver polished metal Snap-on cases, the light of which I've not seen before. And a very, again, just a very slight curve to mirror the outside of the building. I don't envy whoever had to fit those.
Yeah, I can tell you it was a big task.
I bet it was. We'll leave the guys to get on. Tobias is showing us around Porsche Penske Motorsport, the European headquarters for the WEC team here just outside of Mannheim. Now, this is brakes. Even I know that.
Yeah, and I mean, as you can see, those flight cases, they go with us everywhere. Our spare parts are in those flight cases, and here we have complete rear end already assembled and corners, so we can quickly use them if we need to. And yeah, that's what the guys in sub-assembly do. And then they go into those cases and they get pushed into the trucks.
You guys know what's in each particular case and where to go if you do need to replace a corner.
Yeah, that's
saves precious moments.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's also, you need to get those rhythms going that you know exactly what to do in what damage case, let's say. And that's why we prepare everything in advance.
And what do we have here?
HV department.
All right.
So, of course, you have to separate it from all the other departments. Yeah. That's where all the batteries are being prepared and all the MGUs, etc. So we have our HV technicians working here.
You wouldn't have had that a few years ago, you see. So that's something brand
mandatory,
new.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and they need special training. It always has to be renewed. And it's actually quite a unique training that you have to go through.
That's safety certificates and things like that
for
working with high voltages.
Yeah, correct.
Well. Wow.
And then right here we have our bodywork assembly department, let's say. So we'd like to separate this into two areas. Today we have some repairs going on as well. We have right here. But usually the process is like this. We have those stands where the parts, when they arrive here from Porsche, because we cannot produce any carbon here on site.
Of course.
The noses, fronts, whatever, or the rears are prepared to specific build-ups. And then they go on the measurement table where we have specific jigs and opportunities to prepare them before they go onto the car.
And they have to be done exactly, as we found out in the WEC, some month after LaSalle. They do very, not just for the cars that are on the podium, they do very specific checks, including 3D scanning of all the cars that finish the race. So you have to be millimeter perfect here.
Yeah, that's correct. And we always carry a lot of spare bodywork as well. As you know, there's a lot of cars now in the championship, and if you touch another car, usually we try to exchange your bodywork to have optimal performance. In that case, we need to make sure that all the spares are fitting exactly like the race spec, and that's why everything needs to be prepared properly.
And also the fixtures and the fittings have to be exactly, again, just saving those precious moments. Now, do you do the painting, and in fact, how much is the painting on this car? Because presumably they come in standard carbon.
Yeah, they're all wrapped with this very thin livery.
Oh my goodness, it is! I can actually see the carbon weave through it.
Yeah, correct. And that's, we have to do it nearly almost after every race. For example, in Qatar, we had so much sanding in the front that even though the bodywork was not damaged, we had to, of course, renew all the wraps. And here you can see all those bodywork carts that we use to ship the bodywork around the world, that it doesn't get damaged. Because if you prepare it very delicately on one side and then you ship it not carefully around the world, then of course it doesn't help. And that's
in Qatar, the Porsche Penske Motorsport team had a separate facility out the back of the pits, just for the spare bodywork bits, because they're running two cars and they have a lot. And in fairness, there is no regulation to say how much you can bring. If you need to find a bit of room for it, you might need to find a bit of room for it. It doesn't all have to go in the pits. But again, this is those things we're talking about, the 1% things you're trying to, which is impossible, we know, in motor racing, but you're trying to meet every eventuality.
And even if you think about those carts, for example, you have to remember when we started here, let's say 2 years ago, the first cars when we went to Sebring last year, they were prepared in Weissach, not even from here, because the facility was not ready yet. And you have to think that not only the team was new, everything was new. So we needed to get the equipment, we needed to build the carts, we needed to get the parts, project was new, the cars were new, so it was a huge task, and right now we are at the stage that we feel very confident. Of course, we have a long way to go, but you see all the development steps over the last year.
That's actually brilliant, because I bet a lot of our listeners, and I hadn't even thought of this either, there's nobody who builds off the shelf a transport trolley that fits Porsche 963 rear end and corners on it, or indeed bodywork. So you, within the organisation, had to design and build that and make sure, as you say, that it was transportable, sometimes air transportable as well.
Yeah, correct. I mean, the first race in Qatar was also air transport, and now Imola, Spa and Le Mans are via trucks. And then second half of the season, from Sao Paulo onwards, is only via air. So the cars and all the equipment, they don't come back to Mannheim until November.
Oh, really?
So we go from here, we prepare the air freight, it goes to Sao Paulo, afterwards to the US, then directly to Fuji, and from Fuji to Bahrain. And yeah, that's why everything needs to be prepared in advance.
So does that mean that any remedial work has to happen on the road, either before you leave one venue or as soon as you turn up with the next? And does that mean, logistically, you've got to take a bit of extra kit just in case you have to fix something?
Yeah, correct. I mean, we travel with a very big catalogue of parts,
let's say.
But yeah, the preparation happens trackside before and after the events. And yeah, the guys, of course, they have a routine down now. And hopefully this is in the optimum scenario. If we have a casualty and we need to rebuild a car, then of course we would do it from here and ship it again, or rebuild our spare chassis that we take everywhere. But yeah, it's a huge task.
Spare chassis, big talking point in motorsport at the moment. You take one with you to everything?
Correct, yeah. Right. I mean, it has the basic inside setup, so all the loom, all the lines, the fuel cell, everything installed. Mm. So we wouldn't lose that much time if we need to build it.
And again, people probably don't know this, although we mention it in commentary, but I'll say it again. It's not an easy thing. You can't, for example, just pull a car from IMSA, because the series looms that are in there for their series sensors, the logging loom, as they call it, they're not the same between the two championships, and that's quite a job, I'm told.
Yeah, yeah, it's not a plug and play, let's say, and use one car in both championships, but we currently preparing one car in the US for Le Mans. So the third car is currently prepared to wax spec in the US.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, especially like similar to what you just said, you can also not use a test car that easily because of the additional looms that are installed to get measurements, etc. So for example, we have the test car here that just did the endurance test in Aragon and a performance test in Spa. I'm sure you got the news that Sebastian Vettel was driving for us in.
That's the car that Sebastian Vettel's at.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, I'm looking at a bit of history there. Yeah. That's cool. Well, we'll finish up next to this car because Tobias has got a lot to do. You're allowed a complete test team in terms of the FAIWEC. How many tests do you do a year, as well as the championship itself?
Yeah, in the homologation year, so last year it was,
let's say, in a quote unquote normal race year.
Yeah, yeah. And I was just trying to make the comparison to last year. The testing was open, so you could test every 3 second, let's say. But now it's regulated, so the days are regulated, and we try to squeeze in all the tests, of course, before Le Mans to get as much data as possible. So in the beginning of the season, we've been to Barcelona, and then we had a few tests now in the last few months in Imola and in Spa, and as well the endurance test, as I mentioned before, in Aragon. And we'll have one more before going to Le Mans after Spa race, and then we hopefully are prepared for the big one.
Tobias, thank you very much indeed for showing us around. I bet you don't have to have any motivation to come to work on a morning.
No, I mean, it's a very special place to work at, and I always try to tell everybody, this only exists for one reason, and the reason is to win races and to win Le Mans, and everybody's here for the same reason. So the team got built just for that, and that's why it's a very special environment and everybody's super motivated. So yeah, it's a huge honor to be a part of the project.
Inside on RadioLeMans.com.
No visit to Porsche Penske Motorsport Mannheim would be really complete without a chat with a man at the top. That's Urs Karatla, the director of racing LMDH for Porsche. So, just over a year or so into the racing programme, how does he feel it's progressing?
We are probably a bit more than halfway through, put it this way. Last year was a difficult year for us. We started the programme with a complicated way. We mentioned it quite a lot of times already. We had the customer cars there. We started at the same time in two series, in the IMSA and in the WEC, and that made it complicated. I wouldn't say we did not struggle, but we came the long way, put it this way. We had some issues with the car. We had some issues also with the operation. We performed or we developed a really good last year during the season, and obviously we used the winter time, even though there is no winter time anymore in motorsports, but we used every free moment or free time or off track time to develop the organization, the operation and the reliability of the car. And I think the results we can see in the beginning of this season, we started quite well into the season in the IMSA and also in the WEC, and halfway through, because now it starts to pay off that we have two teams. We have the one team based here in Mannheim, and we have the other team based in Mooresville doing the IMSA series. And now it really pays off that those two teams are working together, and it's becoming better and better. And all the test results will be shared also. We have the customers, where we also obviously show, especially if it comes to reliability topics, that we have the customers who are playing a big role in that whole game. And once again, halfway through. There's more to come, and we have to prove. There's always more to come.
Can I ask, how much of last year then, for you, and I suspect for the other manufacturers as well, with particularly with LMDH cars, GTP cars, how much of last year was just getting to know the cars and getting them to be reliable? And have you moved from that in that respect to now trying to unlock performance potential?
I mean, that's different from manufacturer to manufacturer. I think we have some manufacturers which were faster up to speed, then maybe struggled a little bit on the last bit, and again, it's different for every manufacturer. For us, it was it took us more than half the last season,
right. And
that's the total of the last WEC and IMSA season. So, which is basically, if you want, almost one complete season to get up to speed.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the reality, and you could see this in the results.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, again, it took half a season, three quarter of a season to get up to speed. But now it's going.
There seemed to be a change in your fortunes brought about by a change in performance after Le Mans. And let's be blunt about this: Le Mans last year wasn't great for Porsche. I'm sure you would say that you used that to identify and move forward. But the second half of the season was much better, both in the WEC and in IMSA.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely true. But, I mean, Le Mans, that bad result, and it really was a bad result, no doubt about this one in Le Mans, that gave us an extra push to really make sure. But I'm not saying we were sleeping before that.
We were pushing
quite hard, and Le Mans was a... I mean, we had a lot of new things on the car for Le Mans last year, and in Le Mans, some of them failed also. But then
was that a calculated risk, Urs, that you wanted to try and find performance?
It was a miscalculated risk, if anything. But no, it was not. I mean, there's nothing to play around with Le Mans. I mean, Le Mans is the biggest race for us. That's no secret and no doubt. And there's no compromise to make. For Le Mans, so that also this year, I mean, everything is focused on Le Mans now, especially after Daytona. And no, that was just simply after Le Mans last year, we had, as I said, this extra push, and it was really a wake up call for the very last guy in the project who did not realize what's important and what not. But anyways, then all the bits and pieces came together. I mean, we had some structural changes after Le Mans, not entirely because of the result of Le Mans, just because the time we were in the project. But after this, as I said, it went upstream.
Mm. You said there's not a big gap. There's no gap between the end of one season and the beginning of the next. Now, you finished pretty strongly in 2023. And my goodness, both teams have started incredibly well, both in the IMSA Championship and in the World Endurance Championship. That's the perfect start for 2024. But I presume there's no complacency here.
No, it was a perfect start. And the WEC start in Qatar, in Losail, the race, and also this, we pointed out many times, that race really came to us because that suited the car the best, and that's probably the best track for the car we will see in the entire season. However, we like the victory, that much is sure. But what I personally also liked a lot is to see how the WEC team developed, because all those changes we just spoke about, we did in the operational side with the WEC team. They could prove during a Qatar test at the end of November last year that we had this, some more tests with the team. But this, again, very young team performed really, really well in Qatar, and that it's all growing back together to a proper race team now, and that was really, really nice to see how that went. So beside the fact that the victory in Losail was good, the performance of the team and how that all works together with the people back in Weissach, where the development center from Porsche is, and also with the IMSA team, which is in Mooresville, that relationship that grew a lot since the last race, and that was nice to see.
Great win at Daytona as well. Four drivers who hadn't won before at Daytona, not the overall, at least. How much back and forth is there? Look, it's Penske on both sides of the Atlantic. Well, how much back and forth is there between the two teams? Because the cars are pretty much identical, but not totally identical.
No, they are, yeah. You say correctly, they are not quite, or they're quite correct, they're quite identical, that the cars, the forwards and backwards is actually, in terms of people traveling, is not much. I mean, there's only a few people. There's Stefan Moser, the technical director from the program, myself, and some few, only a few engineers from Germany, which are traveling to the IMSA races. And then the team is operating independently, but using all the technology from today, having all the internet connections, all the ops rooms, etc., those two teams, they are, or actually three teams, if you take the development guys from Weissach, the team here in Mannheim, and the guys in Mooresville, those teams are, they're grown together to one unit. People sitting in the ops room, and we also have these fancy, funny situations where one guy says, oh, let's have a coffee after the session and discuss it, and the other guy says, oh, I'm sorry, I'm in Europe and you are in the US.
Yes.
So that's how much they grew together already. That's one thing. So
they consider themselves to be in the same room almost, exactly. Even when it's on the end of an internet connection. The tracks that you race on in WEC and the tracks that you race on in IMSA are entirely different. And yet it's the same car. That's the whole point of this regulation. So how much of the technical information then is relevant between a car that, say, has to be good at Sebring and then on the streets of Long Beach to a car that's coming from the billiard table smooth Qatar and going to Monza or Spa or Imola rather, or Spa or Le Mans?
I mean, interesting question, because the tracks as such, you cannot really compare, as you say, and there's not much performancing. But on the other hand, we have tracks in the IMSA, like, for example, Sebring. And if a car lasts for 12 hours in Sebring with no reliability problems, it probably lasts everywhere in the year. So that's how we benefit from those two different track characteristics, if you want. But performance-wise, it's a big variety. And we often have discussion whether it's a positive that we have a car who has to work on both,
yes,
a kind of tracks or not. At the end of the day, I strongly believe it is a positive, because we have a bigger variety. We learn much more about the car, and we can bring it all together. But at the same time, that also creates a lot of data, and it creates a lot of data, and you have to handle it. And that's something we struggled in the beginning of last year, because to bring that all together for the performance group sitting in Weissach, it's double the amount of work, double the amount of data, etc., and you have to be able to handle it. But under the bottom line, it's a positive, it's a pro.
From a technical point of view, these are very, first of all, we should make the point, I have heard people saying, I'm not interested in sports car racing since LMP1 went away, because the cars aren't technical enough. oh, all right then, come and see if you can run an LMDH car. These are very technical cars, particularly in the systems area. So how much of what you have been learning and where the learning needs to continue, how much of that is ones and zeros and systems? How much of that is still ride height and camber and caster and spring rates?
It's a lot of ones and zeros, definitely. It's a lot of simulator work, and it's less and less toe camber and ride height, because that comes, these numbers and the best compromise of these numbers, they're coming out of the simulation, which is again one and zero. So therefore there's a lot of simulation work, there's a lot of software work as well, and operating in a series which is very, very regulated. Because with all the standard parts, all the standard components, the software is one of the fields you can differentiate to the others. And that's obviously something we and also the other competitors investing a lot in software, in having different maps, different brake maps whatsoever. That's one of the few fields we really can freely develop on this series. And that's why it's a lot more ones and zeros, and like also, but in other series, I just recently spoke to some Formula One guys as well. Toe camber, ride height, that's more and more in the background, because also mechanics are not adjusting it anymore at the racetrack, or a very few one springs, damper settings is the same, because it's so, these numbers are coming so reliable and so good out of the simulation work that it's not necessary anymore.
And so where does that ones and zeros, where does that software integration and, you know, how, for example, your brake-by-wire system works, how does that come about? Is that traditional testing, or does that come out of the simulation as well?
It's probably, especially brake-by-wire and things like this, in different conditions with different brake sets, that's something you really have to track test. That's one of the things you have to track test. Of course, also there you come out with a simulated setting, which is supposed to be the good one, but then you have one or two on the left or on the right, and that's really something you have to track test. And also, not to forget, the driver is still a manual, is still a human being sitting there and in the car. And these guys, they have their feelings, they have these things, what they like and they don't like, and that's really something you have to track test, even though even their simulator work is getting more and more, yeah, or is better and better.
And of course, last year you were pretty much unlimited in what you could do testing. That's not the case in 2024.
No, we are limited in testing. The rules are slightly different from the IMSA and the WEC, and you have manufacturer days, you have test days, team test days, sorry. And the rule set, it's not complicated at the end of the day, but it's strongly limited, and it will also be more and more restricted in the future years. The homologation period goes until 2027, as we all know, and we will have less and less test days available there, which also makes sense because the car technically remains the same.
Yes.
And the cost is a big thing for everybody. I mean, budgets, we are all on a budget, and we all reach the budget limits, and we are fighting with this one, and that makes sense. But to answer your question, yes, there are limitations on testing.
Let's go back to some of the basics of the car. And take you back to the genesis of the car. The 963 is undoubtedly a Porsche. I'm looking at a picture there next to the RS Spyder, appropriately, actually, and I'll come on to that in a moment. It's, to me, it always has looked like a Porsche. I love the integration of the rear light bar as well, like the straight cars. It's a really nice touch. Let's talk about the commonality between the DNA between that RS Spyder and the 963, because the basis of the engine in the current car came out of that championship, US championship winning RS Spyder.
Exactly, that's the basis of the mother of the engine is the RS Spyder. Then we had it in the 918 road car, or the super sports car from Porsche, and now we finally have it in the 963. Obviously the exhaust system is slightly different, and some details are different on the engine, but there's a lot of common on the whole thing, on the design. You mentioned the light bar at the rear, which is, if I'm allowed to say, from the budget, a rather expensive part of the car. But that's part of the series. That's not only a Porsche intention. That's really something which came out of the from the governance bodies. The cars, they really have to represent their brand. And I think Porsche, we did a good job on this one. But also, if you look at the other hypercars, or GTPs, as they're called in the IMSA, you really can see the other brands out of their cars. Okay. And I think that's a very interesting, to be totally honest, initially I thought that's a useless thing in the rules. Why do we do things like this? Because a race car usually should have nothing which is not technically driven on it. But I really have to admit that looking at the series and also to see how the series develops, that's a key element of the two series. I think that's an important.
And the guys in marketing like it. That's the other thing. Just on the engine, was it an easy choice? Porsche have, down through the years, created some phenomenal racing engines and some phenomenal road engines. Was it an easy choice to base it on something you already had? Or was that, for example, was that budget driven?
It was not a budget driven decision. That was a purely entirely technical decision. And at the time, you have to take a decision like this. The rule set, it's not 100% carved in stone. So that was also a little bit of a guesswork, if you want, if that's the right choice to do. Unfortunately, fortunately, Porsche has a big variety of different engines. And the only budget-driven component was that we tried not to develop an entire new engine like we did with the 919 with the 4-cylinder 2-liter engine. So that was the only, probably the only budget-driven decision. But at the end of the day, once we had the rule set, as clear as it was at the time, that was an easy decision to go for the V8.
And it proved to be a good one. There was some talk about developing that engine again with a new crankshaft. I've seen you quoted as saying we wouldn't do that before Le Mans. There's some regulations there as well, in fact, from WEC about when you can bring that in. Is that from a reliability point of view? Is that from a performance point of view? Or is it just from a point of view as, look, we're Porsche, we like to keep looking at things?
No, we do like to keep looking at
things. I've been around a while, Urs, in fairness.
Yeah, no, that's one thing. But that decision or the discussion came up, and there was a reliability thing. Thinking back last year in Le Mans, we had 2 out of 3 failures. They were vibration driven. The concept from the crankshaft we have currently in the car vibrates more, but that's also the easier way to get the performance. It's also fuel consumption is an issue and a number of things. That was the reason why we decided that kind of crankshaft we have currently in the car. After Le Mans last year, we had to start and think how to reduce the vibrations on the engine, and that was one thing which came out. In parallel, obviously, we worked on all these reliability topics, and we developed a lot. And now, as we stand currently today, and there's an ongoing discussion back in Weissach about it, it's not sure whether we introduce that crankshaft, because also that costs a lot of money. Not to forget, we have at the moment we have 3 customer cars running in WEC and in the IMSA, and maybe even more next year. And all those engines, they have to be rebuilt, and that becomes a serious budget issue at the end of the day. At the same time, we developed, as I said, all the reliability points. So as we speak now, we are sure we are not introducing it in Le Mans. That much is sure. Whether we introduce it after Le Mans, it's not decided yet. Then
there is a WEC diktat, I believe, that any changes have to be done 2 races before Le Mans.
Exactly, and that also makes sense from the point of view from the governance bodies, because we have the BOP in place, and they need to balance. They need to be able to balance any new concepts like this, and that gives the lead time from about 2 races. Right. And that's a fair point, and we have to. That's one thing. And then also, once we introduce it in one engine or in one car, or if we put it this way, if we change the homologation, then we have to have all the driving cars, including all the spare engines, etc., at the same time. That brings us to a logistical problem we would also face. Long story, it is a long story, and the long story short, we are not sure whether we do it or not.
Okay, so it's not going to happen before Le Mans. It may not happen at all, because you feel that with the technical developments that you've made, you've mitigated most of the problem, let's say.
Exactly. I mean, we did 24 hours of Daytona, we had the 12 hours of Sebring, we had the 10 hours of Qatar with no problems in the field. All of our customers and also the four works cars in total had no reliability problems there. So there's also a reason why should we do it, because there's also challenges with, again, fuel consumption and other issues with the engine, which we have to overcome with the new crank.
And would that have come in, and we're getting a bit technical here, but is that what they call a waiver or a joker in WEC? Do you have to ask for permission to effectively not homologate the whole car, but homologate a new part for the car?
Exactly. That joker term is a little bit...
I don't like that term.
I think nobody really likes it. However, what is definitely true, that we have to present it to the governance bodies, WEC and the IMSA. They both have to agree, because it's one homologation for both series. And we do have to ask for permission to do it. Obviously, if you start a project or a discussion like this crankshaft discussion, you go straight away to the governance bodies. So there we are in a transparent dialogue with them, telling them what we are planning to do, and they give us always a heads up whether that's worth doing it or not, because not that we develop something very big and at the end of the day they say it is not going to happen for that or another reason.
Absolutely. Right, let's come back to the here and now. How important for the WEC team was that win at Qatar?
Well, that was huge. I mean, you can see down in the facility, you guys back home or wherever you listen to us, you can't see, but if you see the boys and girls working here, that gave like a fresh wind. I mean, that team, as I said, we changed a lot towards the end of last year. It was nice to see how it developed, and then we have that victory, and that was like that must be like on a the old guys on a sailboat when they have the wind from the back and it pushes the boat further, and that was really nice to see. We have much more laughing faces, people are doing jokes, and we know now we can do it, and these guys know that we can do it, and that was huge for us.
And is there competition, even if it's friendly competition, between here and Mooresville? Because obviously at Long Beach, great strategy and phenomenal driving at the end of the Long Beach IMSA race last year saw the 963 get its first victory. And then the American guys go and open up with the Rolex 24 Daytona. Man, the pressure must have been on here.
Yeah, there is a competition, even if we try, and even if the people say or like to try and say there is no competition, there is a competition, no doubt about this. But that's also, I mean, Jonathan Dugwit, general manager from PPM, myself, and all the people in management who are both the teams, we have to treat it like kids. You know, every family father have to know the feeling. and we have different circumstances in the WEC, because the BOP, the challenge, having the LMH cars in the series, the challenge is a different one, and we have to put it in the right light, and we have to make treat them equally, put it this way. But there is a competition, that's sure.
And of course, everybody comes together for Le Mans, the big one, as we've alluded to before. There's an awful lot of Porsches in the top class at Le Mans. Now, Porsche Penske Motorsport run the works car, but of course they've got to be supported by WEC as well. Logistically, is that an issue that you as Porsche Penske Motorsport have got to look at? Because quite clearly, everybody's got to have the same opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, logistically, Le Mans will be big for us. Le Mans is big for everybody. And as soon as you're running one car more than you do in your regular season, that becomes an extra challenge. We will have our third works car there. That's an extra challenge for Porsche Penske Motorsport. For Porsche Motorsport in total, is with having the customers there and having the customer support for all those customer cars, that's an extra challenge too, together with the challenges of space and you know where to park your or not. We always want more space space to park the trucks and all those logistical things. It's not a nightmare. It's definitely not a nightmare, because it's a nice challenge, because Le Mans is the one and you have to be there, but it's definitely an extra challenge for everybody there.
And do the works cars get first call on spares, or is it a completely separate operation between the works cars and the customer racing?
It's, I mean, new parts we have to select somehow, and we are in the fortunate situation now that we do not have to prioritize works teams over the customer teams. Last year, at times, we were in that situation. We had to wheel and deal with different the parts, forwards and backwards. We often had customer cars who had, for example, bodywork parts, which were stickered in red, having parked at their back. That was a real open communication and also an open exchange from parts right now at the moment, and I hope that remains like this until Le Mans, but we do not have to prioritize because we have enough parts in the pocket. But logistically it's a challenge.
Just before we leave the subject of Le Mans and ask you about a little bit about the future, if I may, what did you learn from Le Mans last year as a group that makes you think you'll be better this year at Le Mans?
It's definitely the preparation. And it's not that we didn't know last year, but we haven't had a possibility or we haven't had the chance to prepare ourselves better down to the part situation, the supply chain problems we had at the time, the reliability problems we had at the time. We simply did not have the preparation for the race, which was needed this year. Went through all those things with all those developments and all those changes we did, as we discussed before, we are in a way better situation. But also in the beginning of this talk, I told you we are about 50% through the whole thing, because if I remember back how we prepared in the 919 program in year three or two, three and four, we were there. And to me, it's within the family, so kind of I can tell it, but with how Audi, for example, was prepared, doing years and years and years of Le Mans, that was the perfection of being prepared for a 24-hour race, having all these spare parts, including the tools ready at the back, pre-ran already at the rollout somewhere. And this is something we are way better this year, much better prepared this year than we have been last year, simply because we haven't had the chance to do so, but there's still a lot more we can do.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It's the tiny little things sometimes, particularly at Le Mans. Everybody thinks Le Mans, it's a long race. You've got time. You've never got time in any motor race, even at Le Mans. So having a pre-built corner and all the parts, like, you're right. I remember Audi doing that, talking to Brad Kettler down through the years and going, when the driver says he's got this problem, we've already got the bits out before he even gets to the pit lane and the tools to go with. Let's look forward to, I'm not sort of skipping over Le Mans, because Le Mans is Le Mans, it'll look after itself, and we'll talk to you again, I'm sure, closer to the time and at the big race. Looking forward, you said there's a possibility for more customer cars looking further forward, not this year, but for next year, new customers or extra cars for the customer you've got, or potentially both. And is there a ceiling on how many cars Porsche can support from Weissach?
I mean, both possibilities are possible. Anything is possible. The ceiling is initially the program, the customer support program is set up to have four customer cars in each series. That's the maximum. I'm not saying that's the absolute ceiling and there's nothing more happen, but that's how the program is set up in terms of at the end of the day, it's a business case, but also the manpower, material, which is ordered, etc., etc. So that's the maximum we can assume. Whether we reach that, it's a different story, because we also learned, and it's not a secret, we learned over the course of last year that there are not so many customers around the corner who can do it. There's a lot of people who wants to do it, but at the end of the day, to financially being able to do a complete season, either IMSA or WEC, it's not much different. And there's not many people out there who are able to do it. So whether we reach those four in each series, or if we concentrate to some others, three each series, whatever, that's still open. We start the discussion actually as we speak now. We reach out to potential customers and we continue the talks we already had over the last 2 years.
And you talking about that budget there is an extra WEC race this year. Is the calendar about right now for WEC, or would you welcome another race, maybe a race in Germany, a race in the UK?
A race in Germany and a race in the UK would be great. That's no doubt about it, because I'm sure we have a big fan base in Germany and in the UK to do it. That would bring two extra races. They're different point of views. There's an operational point of view, which is and a budget point of view, which is obviously less races would be better. There's a marketing point of view, and that I believe is one of the most important things, and also the fans out there, because we really have to bring that great series. And I believe since the 90s or whenever, there are different point of views as well, but but this is probably the best sports car era we are going into, or we are in at the moment. Correct. And that's something we really have to present to the fans, and we have to go wherever the fans are. So that potentially means there are more races, and if that's the way to go, then we will adapt to this one.
Finish off with this thought then. You've come a long way, as you've said. Still work to do, as you've said. Porsche being Porsche, there'll still be little refinements all the way along as well, as we've mentioned. Where are the challenges coming next for Porsche Penske Motorsport, and indeed for the 963 programme? Where do you think you guys need to continue to work?
I mean, everywhere. The headline, if you have to say it in one word, is quality. I mean, quality on every aspect is the one we have to work in. We have the basis, we have the ingredients to be successful. We proved this one, and you also can see here what we have with the race base here in Mannheim. We've got everything we need, but we have to work on the quality of every single component, or every single person also working in the program. And the challenge also will be, as we are in a BOP series, and we have luckily we have a lot of competition around, there's a lot of people with very, very professional race teams, and we have to compete against these guys, and we have to be successful against these guys, and that will be the biggest challenge to keep up.
Well, and now there's so many cars in the top class that you cannot afford a non-finish. You can't afford to be at the back. If you're going to win a championship, you've got to be scoring points every round.
Every race you have to score points, and you have to do the best you can. There's nothing to relax or to sit back, and that's at the end of the day. It's also quality. That's what I mean by quality. We really have to bring it every time together as a complete group and perform as good as possible against a big, big competition. And that's the nice thing on this one.
You're still enjoying it, though, because you've smiled a lot while I've been talking to you.
Yeah, I enjoy. Bex is here also. That's why I enjoy it. No, it's really challenging, but it's also enjoyable, because we are in a great series with great competition, and we have the biggest race, to me, the biggest race in the world ahead of us, so there's no way not to smile.
Urs Kratle, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
This programme is a Radio Show Limited production.
Tell your friends there's more at RadioLeMans.com.